Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program for Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. Our guest speaker will be Angela Bates, Executive Director and past President of the Nicodemus Historical Society. The topic of her talk will be Slavery, Migration, Exodusters, and Kansas Black Towns, the Story of Nicodemus. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 7, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Edgar Hicks.
Nicodemus is 300 miles from Omaha. And to go there, it's halfway basically between Kansas City and Denver. And to drive out there, the first time I drove out there, all I could think about was, it seemed like it was a long drive. And I was in a car. Can you imagine what the descendants must have been like in 1877 to make that journey? How did they get there? And I know she's going to talk about that, but those are the things I treasure, and that's what I hope you get from this, the effort and the struggle that these descendants have to get to where we are now. Angela, why don't you do the rest of the introduction for me? Angela Bates, our guest speaker tonight.
Good evening. To just give you a little bit more in terms of my own personal background, I grew up in Pasadena, California. My parents both were born and reared in Nicodemus, and my genealogy goes back to those original settlers that settled there in 77, 78, and 79. And so my genealogy on both sides go back to those original settlers. But my parents, in the mid-1950s, decided they needed to leave and try to find work. And that was a part of the second wave of people out of Nicodemus. And so they went to Southern California like a lot of the relatives did. And so I actually spent from about 5 years old on in Pasadena, California. But we'd come back home every summer. We'd come back to Nicodemus and spend a couple of weeks, and that was always the time when we had our Emancipation Celebration, which has been going on for about 135 years. So I grew up in Pasadena, but home has always been Nicodemus. Although many of us that are descendants live outside of Nicodemus, grew up outside of Nicodemus, and maybe only get to Nicodemus once a year, we still consider Nicodemus home. And so we make the trek annually back for the Emancipation Celebration, and sometimes you miss a year or two, but you always try to get back for the celebration. So even though I did not grow up in Nicodemus, Nicodemus is very much a part of my life growing up. And a couple of summers I actually spent there, which it took my parents almost an act of Congress to get me out of there, because I just refused to go. I even hid when it was time for us to leave. But I've always had a passion for the family, for the town, for the history. And so it's not surprising as an adult I ended up making it a profession. It is my passion, but it has become my profession. I was talking to my cousin Herb Rhodes yesterday, and this morning, and we were talking about commodities, and I said I think the commodity of Nicodemus is its history. But I always like to get started with the slave experience, and the reason I say that is because I myself, when I really started to look at the history of Nicodemus in a professional manner, I remember thinking to myself, well, where did these people come from? Yeah, I know they were from Kentucky, but where did they really come from? Did they just drop out of the sky in 1877? Who were these people? Who were they really? And I'm looking at pictures, historical photographs, and my grandmother and other relatives are saying, well, this is, you know, your great-great or your great-great-great grandmother or grandfather or what have you. And I'm like, I really want to know their stories. I really want to know what it was like for them as slaves. So in the early 90s, I decided to actually make a trip to Kentucky. I went on a humanities grant to do some research and then to produce an exhibit called the Kansas-Kentucky Connection. And prior to actually going, I met a man by the name of William McIntyre, and he was on the board at the Scott County Historical Society. And in talking with him, he was the first individual that I talked to and really actually met that knew the story of how the people left Georgetown and other surrounding little towns for the promised lands of Kansas. And I thought, wow, here I'm talking to someone on the other end that knows about the people when they left. So I was really excited when I showed up in Georgetown. I think it was in, I want to say it was in August of 92, I think, 91 or 92. No, it was 91. And I was just my heart was beating and fast, and I was just excited because I'm like, I'm going to go and I'm going to walk the soil and on the grounds and see some of the plantations where my forefathers actually lived as slaves. So I was just all fired up. And when I got there, I met this little short man called Bill McIntyre who knew about the people leaving and all, and I was so excited just to meet him. And he told me that he, after 3 days, we had breakfast every morning at this little place called Fava's. And after the third day, I said, I got the nerve up to ask him where he got those blue eyes. This is a black man, and I swore up and down he had blue contacts on. And I thought, why would this old black man have blue contacts on? I thought that was just weird. And it was at the time, you know, in the early 90s when everybody was changing the eye colors by wearing all these different, what do you call them? Contacts. And so after the third day, I thought, I'm going to ask him. So I did. I got the nerve. I said, why do you wear blue contacts? And he says, I don't have any contacts in. I said, yeah, right. He said, no, these are my eyes. I said, well, where did you get blue eyes from? And he said, the colonel. And I said, well, who's the colonel? He said, he would have been my great-great-great-grandfather. And I was like, and who is he? He's Colonel Richard M. Johnson, vice president under Van Buren. I'm like, what? And I had read in my family's memoirs about my great-great grandparents, Tom and Zarina Johnson, being owned by Vice President Richard M. Johnson, and on that's on my mother's side. And on my dad's side, I read about my great-great-great grandparents being owned by Colonel Richard M. Johnson's daughter. And so here I'm meeting a direct descendant, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. So it just blew my mind. And that just kind of started me on a journey that I'm still on. And I remember that day I met a lot of people that were on the Historical Society board, and they had a little gathering of people that came. And there was a guy by the name of Bias Tilford with a camera, and I'm like, what are you going to do with that? He says, I'm going to film you. And I'm like, what? Why are you going to do that? And he says, because we need to know, and we need to share this with everybody. I said, okay. After it was all over, one of the ladies that was on the Historical Society board came up to me. Ann Bevins is her name. She's a historian of Scott County and has written several books on it. She came up to me, and she mentioned, she said, you mentioned that your great-great-grandparents were owned by Vice President Richard M. Johnson. I'm like, yeah. And she says, how would you like to go to the plantation? And they don't call them plantations in Kentucky. They just call them farms. And I think it's because they never really had large plantations, and it was just about 5% of the white population that actually owned slaves. So, and it's because the topography of the land is just not conducive to large plantations, and they grew hemp and some tobacco during slavery. So they don't call them plantations, they call them farms. So she said, would you like to go over there tomorrow? And I was like, oh my God, absolutely. She said, well, I'm taking a class. So the next day I got a chance to go to Vice President Richard M. Johnson's farm, Blue Spring. And I had read in my cousin's document about Blue Spring, and that was what it was called, and how they had this huge natural spring there. And so I had visions in my mind about the rock walls and what this was going to look like, and it looked exactly like I thought it was going to look. And it just, I felt like Alex Haley. I thought, this must have been how he felt. And so I, since then, I have just been passionate about the history of the people that came to Nicodemus and settled there. You know, a few weeks ago, I was asked to speak in Kansas City for the Martin Luther King celebration. And I'd like to repeat what I said there. I started out and I said, you know, Martin Luther King had a dream. And over nearly 100 years before his speech, there was a group of people that had a dream too. And they made that dream a reality. And they did that in 1877. 1877, the dream of an all-black town where people could govern themselves came into existence. And this was at the end of Reconstruction. This was at a time period when the Civil War was over and the war in the South was over and the people were just living in total fear and it was total chaos because that's what it was like. I imagine this. You're a slave today and your master beat you or sold your children away from you. And tomorrow he's got to tell you you're free. He's going to be scared. He's not going to know what you're going to do. You know, and say I am a slave and my relationship with my master isn't a bad one. And he's got to tell me I'm free. And where am I going to go? You know, I have heard about Lincoln, Nebraska, and that's I've heard it's miles and miles from here, or even the next little town. But I have no idea how far that really is, because my entire life has been spent on a small farm where I was not allowed to leave it. So the geographic mindset is very, very tiny. So the whole concept of moving to the West was probably like us, you know, lining up and you know, someone saying you want to go to the moon or you want to go to Mars or just go up to the space station. How many of us would just be eager to go? And what would it really be like to do that? So when I think back to those people, I think of what it must have really been like for them as former slaves. Now they're free. And then someone comes along and say, yeah, you're free, but you can't really vote. And you better not testify against anyone that's white. And you cannot use any public transportation. And none of you all can gather together in large groups unless it's at church. So, yeah, I've got my freedom, but how can I experience freedom under the Jim Crow laws? So for those people that were living there under those conditions of freedom, it must have been very, very difficult to think that, yeah, I'm free, but what can I really do with that freedom? And where can I really go? I don't even know where to go. Like I said, maybe I have heard of Lincoln, but I don't know if I want to go over there, and why would I want to go? And how am I going to get there, and which direction is it in, and what can I expect when I do get there? So, yeah, you got your freedom, but you have to adjust to that. And what does that adjustment mean? I'm sure there were many that said, we're out of here, we're going to go north as far as we can go. Many of them just crossed the Ohio River, and life for them in a northern state for them where there wasn't slavery was probably enough for them. And some probably just kept on going and said, we're out of here, we're going to go to Canada. But for those that decided to stay, it must have been extremely difficult for them. And then I think about, okay, here we are slaves. I mean, former slaves. We have our freedom. It's you know, the KKK has come into existence, and the Jim Crow laws are just hampering our ability just to survive. But then, you know, the government creates the Freedmen's Bureau to assist African Americans. They provide education for them. They create schools so that now they can officially learn to read and write. And the whole concept of being married and the family unit, how was that affected? Okay, in the case of my great-great-great-grandmother, she watched her first husband be beat almost to death, and then he ran away. And she continuously ran away. But she would only run away for 3 days, and then she'd come back. And pretty soon her master got wind of what she was really doing. And after 3 days, they would put out a notice that was that there was a runaway But she come back that third day. So, you know, she kept running away. And then eventually she ran away and they almost caught her. And she ended up almost suffocating in a trunk where she had hid. She was hiding. But she ran away this last time. And the lady that was hiding her was a neighbor. And when she got wind that the patrollers were coming to search her house, she hid her in a trunk that was right there in the living room, so to speak. And she sat down on the trunk and gave lemonade to the men, and they sat there and talked. And she almost forgot that she was in the trunk. So when she realized that she had left her in the trunk, she hurried to get them out of there. And when she opened the trunk, she had almost suffocated, basically. And from that point on, she did not run away anymore. But the point is, she did run away. And she was so upset to have had to have watched her husband. And, you know, of course, African-Americans that were enslaved, they didn't have any rights over each other. They didn't even have the right to get married. It was not legal for them to get married, but some of the masters would allow them to cohabitate as married people. They would allow them to perform the ceremony of jumping over the broom, so to speak, and calling themselves married. But it wasn't until after emancipation that African Americans could really consider their marriage to an individual legal. And even then, they had to get remarried. And I remember the very first time I was doing the research there in Georgetown, which is just about 10 miles north of Lexington, and I ran my hand up and down the pages of the slave marriage records of people that I knew, people that had come to Nicodemus, and then to see the minister's name on there as the individual that married them and was a witness, and he being one of the first ministers in Nicodemus. It was just something to experience that. But these people, they had endured slavery. And now they were free. And then someone comes along, a white man and a black preacher come along, and they go to the churches and they promote an all-black town named Nicodemus. And they said, why stay here? And you can move west. And you can become landowners. You know, the best they could do was sharecrop. So the whole concept of becoming a landowner and a owner of 160 acres. All they had to do was live there and improve it for 5 years, pay the filing fee, and then they had the land. The land became the draw to settle in an all-black town where they can govern themselves became the draw. The push were the Jim Crow laws. And what was in the violence and of and all of what was going on there in Kentucky after the troops pulled out and there was no militia there anymore to try to keep control of the things and Reconstruction was ended. Life there was very, very difficult. So when someone came along and said, hey, there's another option that you can exercise here. You can go west. You can become a landowner and you can also, if you choose, to live in an all-black town where there's no Jim Crow laws that will affect you. When you walk outside, you will see black faces. When you think about going to the store, you will see black faces. We will govern ourselves in this little all-black town. So the Jim Crow laws became the push, and the draw became the land. And the catalysts were the men that were the town speculators. You know, you could actually, if you wanted to create a town and name it after yourself or anybody, all you had to do was file the same kind of papers, and you would file a town site papers, basically, and name your town, plat it out, and it was left up to you to get people to settle there. And the reason you would do that would be because you could make money, just like the real estate developers of today. Same concept. So these town speculators were helping people to establish towns and getting people to settle in the towns. And the way they made money is by selling town lots. If you wanted to buy and open a business on the commercial street, then those town lots may run you $25. If you wanted to live in town, the residential lots may run you $10 or $15. So that's how they made money. And they created newspapers to really promote their towns, and they would talk about various people who had already decided to move and open up businesses. Well, in the case of Nicodemus, the town speculator that was involved was a white man by the name of W.R. Hill. W.R. Hill was responsible for people getting settled in the towns of Wichita and Hutchinson. And then he ventured out to the northwest part of the state of Kansas, where he could practically see Nebraska and the Colorado border, and said, "My God, there's nothing out here. I'm going to create a town and name it after myself." And he did, Hill City. But before he did, he met a black homesteader by the name of Smith, and he convinced Smith to go into partnership with him. And they created the Nicodemus Town Company. They located the site, which is on the north side of the Solomon River, and then they went to Topeka, and they met with four ministers, and all of them together created the Nicodemus Town Company. And then they said, "Now, how are we going to get people to settle here, and where are we going to get them from?" And they said, "Well, I guess we could go back home." And home was Kentucky. So they went back to Kentucky. W.R. Hill went with Reverend Roundtree, and they went to the churches because of the Jim Crow laws, and they promoted the town of Nicodemus. And they said, "Do not stay here. You have an option. Don't listen to Frederick Douglass, who said stay here in the South. Go west. If you come out west, you can live in this all-black town named Nicodemus." And it was named Nicodemus not after the biblical Nicodemus, although there are a lot of biblical similarities and parallels there. The name of the town was actually selected based on the song, "Wake, Nicodemus." And it was a song that was popular at the time, and they said that slaves had sung this song on the plantations. And it basically said that Nicodemus was a slave of African birth and was bought for a bag full of gold. And it says that he talked about a better time coming and to wake him up for the great jubilee. And I think the reason they selected the name Nicodemus was because of that song and the fact that the time had come. They could really experience freedom now. And so even though there were ministers that were involved in the organizing of the town, it was really the name Nicodemus, not the biblical Nicodemus, but the slave who was supposedly the first to purchase his freedom in the United States, and the prophet, so the song says, that they selected the name from. And again, there's a lot of similarity with the biblical connotations, because Nicodemus was the one that went to Christ and said, "How can a man be born again by re-entering his mother's womb?" And Christ said, "It's not about the physical rebirth, it's about the spiritual rebirth." And Nicodemus was established by what was termed at that time Exodusters. I was asked today, "Well, what was the who were the Exodusters and why were they called Exodusters?" African Americans were beginning to leave the South in large groves, especially between 1879 and 1880. Now, we all know that the Smithsonian and has created exhibits about the Great Migration North in the 30s. And when we think about the Great Migration of the African Americans, most of us think the 1930s. But it was the first real migration of the African American out of the South, really took place around 1877 and even a little bit before then, all the way to 1880. And specifically, there were about 40,000 African Americans that migrated to the state of Kansas between 1879 and 1880. And the reason they came was because of the land. And the people that were actually promoting this exodus, one man in particular, his name was Pap Singleton, Benjamin Pap, as they called him, Singleton. And he considered himself the father of this exodus. And they were leaving in such large groves that the government said, "Wait a minute, why are so many blacks migrating to the West? What, and into the state of Kansas specifically? What's going on?" And, of course, it was the homesteading, and it was the actual idea of the land. But they wanted to know why there was this mass exodus and who was the cause of it. And so they created a committee to study why there were so many African Americans actually moving into the state of Kansas specifically. And Pap Singleton went and testified before Congress, and he says, "It's me. I take responsibility." He went all over the South, Tennessee, I won't say all over the South, but he went to the western border states, and he really promoted the exodus. He said, "Do not stay here. Do not deal with these Jim Crow laws and the violence. Go west. Become landowners." And so the word spread like wildfire. And so people decided they were going to leave. And they left in groves. You've heard of 40 acres and a mule. That's where it came from. If we go to Kansas, we're going to get 40 acres and a mule. Well, they can get the 40 acres, but I don't know if they ever got the mule. But people left in groves. And so this was called the Exodus. And the people were called the Exodusters. But in the case of Nicodemus, even though they were Exodusters, so to speak, they were a part of an organized effort to create this town and to settle it by former slaves. They were solicited specifically to come to the little town of Nicodemus, where typically your Exodusters are known to be ones that heard about it, got on the boats and left, and came really unprepared for what they could actually experience in Kansas, even though it was a free state. They had to set up tent towns in Topeka and Atchison and Leavenworth and all the eastern towns there in Kansas to accommodate the influx of all of these African Americans. And then there were ones that that lived in Texas that came also. They were called Texodusters. So there was this mass migration. And it was the first mass migration of African Americans out of the South. And they were coming into the state to become owners of land. Most of them did not homestead. Many of them ended up staying in these larger urban areas. But then the governor, St. John and Anthony, they were encouraging people to go to places like Nicodemus that had already been established a couple of years ahead of time, to go to some of these little black towns that were beginning to pop up and go settle there. And so Nicodemus really was started 2 years before the major exodus of 1879 and 1880. It was really an organized effort to get people to come and settle in this town, opposed to people just getting on the boats and just showing up. Well, when W.R. Hill and Reverend Roundtree went to Kentucky, they went to the churches, and they had promotional flyers that they used to promote the town. Of course, many people could not read, but they distributed the posters, and they encouraged people to move to Nicodemus. And they said, "We'll be back." And this was earlier during the spring that they actually came to Kentucky and promoted the town of Nicodemus. And they said, "We'll be back. We'll be back in the fall. We'll be back in September. And you have time enough to get yourselves together. And when we come back, we'll lead you all out to this great state of Kansas and to this little town that will be your home called Nicodemus." So about 350 people decided they were going to make that trek. They saved their money up for the train ride, which I believe cost about $8. And then once they got on the train, and this was the first time many of them had even seen a train, they got on the train and they went west. Well, they went north first to Cincinnati. And once they got to Cincinnati, that was the major hub for trains going east and west. Then they got on trains in Cincinnati and went all the way out to the great state of Kansas, to a place called Ellis. And they still had a two-day walk over to the little town site of Nicodemus. Now, my grandmother on my mother's side was pregnant at the time, and so it must have been a very scary journey for her. Imagine that. You know, she's a former slave. She's carrying a child that's going to be born into freedom. Her first child being born into freedom and being born on free soil. She must have been excited. That excitement and eagerness to go west evidently dissipated any fears that she may have had about going to a strange place and being pregnant. And she traveled with her mom and her dad and her sister and her brother. Her mom and dad were Tom and Zarina Johnson, and they had all been owned as slaves by Vice President Richard M. Johnson. So when they got to Nicodemus after that two-day trek, the sight of Nicodemus was very disheartening for a lot of folks. Because if you've ever been to Kentucky, the topography of the land is such that it's very hilly, and there's a lot of rocks, and there's trees everywhere, and there's water everywhere. And the Elkhorn Creek, which runs right through that area where many of them fished and probably bathed in and what have you, was a lot larger than the Solomon River. Solomon River was, I think, probably in its deepest point, it's probably maybe 4 feet deep. But, and it's dry most of the time. So when they got out there and they started to see the change in the lay of the land once they started getting west of Topeka, when they got into what is called the Flint Hills, you can see for 40 miles without even on your tiptoes. So for them to start to see land and seeing it as far as the eye could see must have been a major eye-opener. Coming from the forest of Kentucky, now you can see 40 miles without even blinking. And then the closer they got to the high plains where Nicodemus was, the more cactus they actually saw, because this was called the Great American Desert. Nicodemus is in an area that's called, we're on the very end of the high plains, but it's all prairie. And there are still cactus and yucca plants that are out there amongst the wheat fields and everything else. But imagine what they must have felt like coming to a place where they could see for miles. And they thought, this is going to be our new home. There's not a tree in sight. Now, what are we going to do to build a house with? And that was the challenge. Because many of them who had lived in slave cabins that were made of stone or rock or even wood, those little homes were nice, cozy homes. They had little fireplaces and what have you. Those slave cabins may not have been the best, but that was better than living in holes in the ground, which were called dugouts. Dugouts were basically 14, 15 feet long and wide and about 6 feet deep in the ground. And if you could find a knoll or an embankment where you could dig back into, that would be great. But a lot of the land was not like that, so they would have to literally kind of dig in at an angle and or pile dirt on and then dig in. And they lived in these dugouts for a number of years. As a matter of fact, my grandmother was actually born in a dugout. My grandmother was born in a dugout. And a lot of the dugouts stayed around for years and years and years. And after that first year, someone got a plow on the town site, and they started to create sod houses, which was basically the virgin soil of Kansas cut into bricks, so to speak, and stacked up. And so Nicodemus was dotted with dugouts and soddies for years and years, and that's what they lived in. And when they got on the town site, like I said, many of them were like, oh, my God, this is Nicodemus? Where's the store? There were no businesses. There were no above-ground buildings. So can you imagine that? You're thinking you're going to go to this place that is called Nicodemus. It's going to be an all-black town there. There are already a few people there, so they're thinking some semblance of a street, a road, of something, any above-ground building that made it look like it was a town. And all they saw was a few dugouts here and there. And when the second group came in 1878 that spring, about 60 of them said, you know what, we're out of here. We've been lied to, and we're out of here. We're going to go back. So even though they had hopes of seeing a town that was somewhat a semblance, resembling a town of some kind of way, they didn't see any of that. But that was not enough to discourage the majority of them. And I was telling someone just a couple of months ago, we were working with the National Park Service writing a walking tour brochure. And there was a paragraph in there that talked about the people that turned around and left and what they saw and how bad it was. And, you know, it went on and on and on. And I said, you know what? Wait a minute. This is not a story about the people that left. This is a story about the people that stayed. The people that stayed had vision. They wanted to make their vision a reality. They wanted to make sure that this little town, this little spot out in the middle of nowhere was going to be home. And they were determined to make it that. And so they literally dug in for the winter, did the best they could to get the first dugout dug for my grandmother, who had the first baby born in Nicodemus on October the 30th, 1877, a month later. And I just finished working on a photographic book of the children of Nicodemus, and I wrote a statement in there because I think this is probably how it really was when that little baby boy called Henry, the first baby born on free soils in Kansas, the first generation born free after slavery, I think God himself said to the angels, it's time to sing. I think everybody that had passed on before them must have been so happy and joyful that here is the first child being born into freedom on free soil. And so my great-grandmother must have been so pleased to have had the first child born in Nicodemus, the first child born into freedom. She had to have been joyful. And when I think about those kids growing up there in that first generation, it must have been a wonderful thing for them to watch their children not have to deal with the constraints and all the things that were imposed on them as they were growing up as slaves, and to know that their children did not have to worry about ever becoming slaves, and they themselves would not ever have to worry about their children being sold away from them or taken away from them. And here in this little town called Nicodemus, they could truly experience freedom. They could govern themselves. So they looked around and they didn't see anything but the open prairie, but they knew that they were on free soils. They knew that they were in a place that they could call home, Nicodemus. And so they were determined to make it a reality. They were going to make this town work. And so when winter set in and they ran out of supplies almost immediately, and they had to make a two-day trek over to Ellis where the train was to get supplies and then turn around and take a two-day trip back. And when they couldn't do that anymore because of the weather and they had to just kind of hunker in for the winter, they ran out of supplies, they shared what they could, and a miracle happened. You know, this was at a time when Native Americans had been forced onto reservations and the war in the South was over, but the war in the West was still raging. You know, the government was trying to subdue the Native American and force them onto reservations. And the Cheyenne Dog soldiers and many other tribal members of different tribes refused to go to Oklahoma and be neighbors with some of their natural enemies, so to speak. This was a time when it was still very volatile, even right there in Kansas. And the Osage Indians and the Potawatomi Indians both claim that they came to Nicodemus and they shared with them game that they had gotten from their hunting trips. Now, my great cousin said it was the Osage, but the Potawatomi Indians and probably many other tribal members of different tribes probably were in the area, traversing through the area. And they shared their game with them. And, you know, when the Buffalo Soldiers, who were the black men that were of the 9th and 10th U.S. Cavalry, 24th and 25th infantry, when they were engaging the Indians in battle, many times they would shout out. They didn't have a beef with them. They didn't want to fight them. They wanted to fight the Wachuchu. They wanted to fight the white man. And so here in this time when the Native American wars were raging and it was typical for people to be deathly afraid of Native Americans, here you have them coming to a little all-black town and saving them from starving to death. That was not the only time that people came and helped Nicodemus, the folks of Nicodemus. There were some other people in the area in a place called Bow Creek, which is about 20 or 30 miles north of there, that traversed through the area and sold them wild turkeys and game, and they helped them to survive. But it's just so ironic that, you know, you talk about the West, you talk about Kansas and all the Indian wars that was taking place in and around there, and Fort Hays, which is just 45 miles to the south, where Buffalo soldiers and other troops, including the 7th Cavalry, were stationed. And right up the road, here was a little all-black town, and Native Americans came and gave those people food to survive that first winter. So if it wasn't for them, we would not have survived. I probably wouldn't be here. Or maybe if I was, I'd probably not have Nicodemus necessarily in my background. But they survived that first year, and they were determined to set down deep roots. And in the spring, the second group came. Spring of 1878, the next group of people came from Kentucky. And in that group, there were people that had the measles. And my great-grandmother, I should say my great-great-grandmother, actually traveled, great-grandmother, traveled with her husband and a child that she had had, and the baby had the measles and died en route. And when the conductor found out there was a dead baby on the train, they put my great-grandmother and her husband and the baby off the train in Solomon, Kansas, which is about 20 miles from Abilene, and they ended up walking to Abilene. And that's where she ended up staying and had other children. And my grandmother was born there and ended up going to school with President Ike. But she ended up marrying a man from Nicodemus, Charlie Williams. He was the brother of Henry, the first baby that was born in Nicodemus. And she taught school in Logan County, which is west of Nicodemus, about an hour. And then they ultimately ended up back in Nicodemus. But her mother and father had been put off the train because of the measles. And when they got to the little town of Ellis where they would get off the train, they had a two-week quarantine. And so people stayed there for 2 weeks before they were allowed to go north 2 days to Nicodemus. And there was people that were from a Mount Pleasant church in Sadieville, and Sadieville is where they really got on the train. Sadieville and a couple other little depot areas around the Georgetown area. But there was a large contingent of the congregation from a church called the Mount Pleasant Church in Sadieville. And when they showed up, actually after 2 weeks of being quarantined in Ellis, they got to Nicodemus, and with them was a Reverend Daniel Hickman and his wife, and 6 kids. And Wilena Hickman said when they got close enough to see the town site, which, you know, you can see for miles out there, she said, "I looked with all the eyes I had, and I still couldn't see Nicodemus." And W.R. Hill said, "You know, see that smoke over there?" He said, "That's where Nicodemus is." And when they got on the town site, she sat down and cried. She said, "This is Nicodemus? You mean to tell me these people that are living in Hosea, this is Nicodemus?" But her husband had vision, and he said, "I'm going to establish a church here at Nicodemus, and I'm going to name it after the church in Georgetown." And he did. He established the Mount Olive Baptist Church. He not only established the Mount Olive Baptist Church, but he established 3 other churches in the area, and even assisted in establishing the first White Baptist Church in Hill City. He became the first coroner, the first chairman of the Board of Commissioners. He left a mark in Graham County, Reverend Daniel Hickman. And where his church stood is a cemetery now, and the cemetery has always been there near the church. And we still use that cemetery today, and it's called the Mount Olive Cemetery. And every time I go to Georgetown, I stop in, if I'm there on a Sunday, to go to the little Mount Olive Church where he was a minister at. And three-quarters of his congregation actually came to settle in Nicodemus. And let me tell you what these people did that first 2 years that they were there. Well, in 1879, the spring of 1879, the last large group of people came. And they came in really from Leavenworth, Kansas. And they came by prairie schooners, you know, the big Conestoga wagons. And when they arrived on the town site, many of the people that they knew in Georgetown, Kentucky, that were on surrounding plantations were already there in Nicodemus. So these people knew each other. And it took me a while to figure that out. It wasn't until I got into the genealogy that I figured out who these people were. I had always heard that there was a group that came from Leavenworth. So I'm thinking, oh, they're just black people that are already living in Leavenworth that came. Well, the people that came were the ones that were related to genealogically or geographically to the people that were on the Johnson plantation or the Johnson's daughter's plantations. So these people that came from Leavenworth in 1879 were already connected to the people there. So in 1879, they had they wanted to organize the county. Let me tell you how savvy these black people were. These are people that came out of slavery with no real education. However, there was a man by the name of Abram Hall and his friend Edward P. McCabe that came, and they immediately put them on the board. And these were educated men that had been working in Chicago and had heard about black towns being organized, and they wanted to go out and help. And so they ended up in Leavenworth and then overheard a guy by the name of Niles, and this was in 1878, and he heard a guy by the name of Niles talk about getting supplies for the people in Nicodemus. So they ended up coming to Nicodemus with Niles in 1878. They wanted to organize the county of Graham County because they were right on the border of the adjacent county called Rooks County. And so they put their minds together, and they went to the land office, and then they went to the governor, and they pleaded with him to organize the county of Graham and to establish the first township, which was called the Nicodemus Township, in the county. These were black people with a serious vision, because a township is 6 miles by 6 miles, 36 square miles. And, you know, I have always known that, but it's just been here in the last 6 months that the light bulb really went off in my head about it. And when I give people tours, I say, now, see the water tower over there where Nicodemus is? From here all the way in, was this land was owned by blacks. And it isn't until you're out on the land and you drive that 36 square miles or the perimeters that you get a feel for how much land African Americans owned. And not only did they own the Nicodemus Township, 36 square miles, but they homesteaded land all the way to the little town of Hill City that Hill established. He started to establish it after Nicodemus was established in 1878 is when he started to work on establishing Hill City. So they homesteaded all the way from Nicodemus to Hill City, which is about 13 miles, and then 8 miles south. And all of this land was homesteaded by African Americans. And I really truly believe that there is not another landmass as large as that that has been owned by African Americans in the United States other than maybe the Gullah Islands. I don't think there is. That just occurred to me here in the last 3 months or so. But that's a lot of land That's almost enough land to create your own state. And Edward P. McCabe and his friend Abram Hall were instrumental in getting everybody together to organize the county and the township. Edward P. McCabe went on to become the state auditor. He was the first black to be elected to, they say, any northern state, but he was definitely the first black elected to any state position in the state of Kansas. He was elected the state auditor for two terms. He first became the clerk of Graham County. And all the officials of the county in when it was organized were all African Americans. The county attorney, George Washington Jones, was an African American. The county attorney, the first two county attorneys were African American. The second one was W.L. Sayers. Yeah, if you guys are familiar with that name, Sayers, that's Gail Sayers' great uncle and also my great uncle. So I'm related to the Sayerses. And so here you have black politicians that had vision and were making waves. They were doing it. Edward P. McCabe went on to become the state auditor for Oklahoma for two terms. And at that time, he really had a vision. He and many others had a vision of an all-black state. But he went to Congress and he pleaded with Congress to give us land in Indian Territory that we could create our own all-black state in and make him the governor. Of course, they didn't see that. And as a result, it just didn't fly. But he had that kind of vision. But he helped to get Nicodemus and the town of Nicodemus and the township of Nicodemus organized and put on the map, as well as the county. And these blacks in Graham County were doing it. They were actually doing it. They had their own black town, and they had their own government, and they were doing it. They were governing themselves, and they were having an experience of true freedom and autonomy. They were doing it. And the town continued to grow. People kept coming into Nicodemus and trickling in from Nebraska, from all over. People would come in and try to get settled and established in the town of Nicodemus. And they had to start homesteading further and further away from the town. And some people even had to go into the next county. And some even went even further west to homestead. But the draw was this little all-black town called Nicodemus. And then in 1976, Nicodemus became a historic landmark district. Of course, that means that we're on a prestigious list of historical places that have national historical significance. But then after 7 years of working with Senator Dole's office and Pat Roberts' office in the National Park Service, the regional office here, we got designated as a unit of the National Park Service. So we are a National Historic Site, a unit of the National Park Service. Yeah, we have the guys with the green uniforms on and the little hats and the little arrow badge. So we're a national park now. And in November the 11th, 1996, President Clinton signed it into law. Nicodemus is now a unit of the National Park Service. And for the generations to come, Nicodemus will be preserved. And so it's a great place. And if you haven't ever been to Kansas, if you've never been to Nicodemus, you're invited to come. And you know what we're finding is more and more people are finding out that they're connected to Nicodemus. Isn't that right, Cynthia? Because, I mean, it's wonderful the number of people that are discovering their connection with Nicodemus. And so as Nicodemus grows, as the families grow and the descendants grow, and as we go from seas to shining seas, as they say, we will not be forgotten. And this little place will become the Mecca for African Americans to look to and to come to experience what black people did here in America. We have that example. You know, we think about how bad it is And I think at times, my God, what are we doing in this country? And I even say that to my cousins. What are we doing with our history? These people that came here and settled here had no education, had no means, had no air-conditioned cars, had no vehicles, had no cell phones. The least we can do is preserve their history and their story. That ought to be easy. And I say to all of us, not just African-Americans, we need to stop thinking about what we don't have and start using what we do have to survive. Really, because these little towns like Nicodemus become the example of what we did as a people when there was nothing. Nothing but the land. They didn't even have tools to build dugouts with. They didn't have a plow to create sod houses until a year later. So when I think about Nicodemus and I think about the people that established that little town, I think about the tenacity and spirit and determination that I think I have that much of. Because I don't know if I could have endured slavery, let alone move to a place almost like to the other side of the galaxy and have a spirit of determination that they did. So when I think about them, I think about how great they were. And how great their story is and how it needs to be preserved and it needs to be told. And everybody needs to know about what the African Americans did with their freedom after emancipation. You know, we jump right from slavery to civil rights. Well, what happened in between? Nicodemus happened in between. And Nicodemus is only an example of one town that survived. But there were many towns that existed that were all African-American. Colorado had one that was called Deerfield, and there was one all the way out in California called Allensworth that was established by African-American man that was in the 9th U.S. Cavalry, and he was a chaplain. He had vision to create an all-black town. And Allensworth, I understand, I've never been there. I've seen pictures, and I've talked to the folks, and even had in my own home some of the people that have lived there. But it's a state park now. So we, as African Americans, have a whole lot to be proud of. And when we turn around and we look at slavery, we should not get mad, even though it is. There are many instances where it's more than enough to get mad over. But think about the people that endured it and what they came out of slavery with, a spirit of determination to do better for themselves. And Nicodemus becomes that icon of what they really did. I thank you.
You've been listening to a program for Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. Our guest speaker was Angela Bates, Executive Director and past president of the Nicodemus Historical Society. The topic of her talk was Slavery, Migration, Exodusters, and Kansas Black Towns, the story of Nicodemus. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 7, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Susan Hart, Public Relations Specialist, and Barbara Velasquez, a Coordinator of International and Intercultural Education at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.